good afternoon.
Oh. Oops. What was that?
I touched the microphone at the same time I talked into it. My bad. It just seemed like it was too far away.
It's like walking and chewing bubblegum at the same time.
Well, that's the wrong angle. There's something going on there. So, anyway, you are catching a...
Anyway.
Anyway. A little inside joke there. It's Bill's mom. We were channeling Bill's mom there for a second. She'll ask you a question, and you get three syllables into the answer, and she'll go, anyway, to talk about something else.
Okay, then.
We tried to get good at it, but we stink at it.
Yeah, we stink at it.
We just go,
laughing.
Anyway, and then we start laughing, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. I tried it again. I still couldn't do it. That being said, you know a lot about Bill's mom, but my name's Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill's mom's Bill.
we talk a lot about our moms because our moms are funny.
Yeah, they're great.
Our moms are funny. It's been kind of a long week. There's been a lot going on, and Ashley's in there repetitively calling our first guest who's not answering his phone. And we're talking about capital gains, so...
That's going to be a short conversation on my part.
Newsflash, we're not winging that one. So we might need to call our second guy, see if maybe he can come on the first hour instead of the second hour. So just in case, you know, you have gone to the website and looked at it and you were trying to follow along, you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. And normally the things on there are accurate. Except for today. Today, they're flexible. We're going to be flexible. And if Myron Magnet is available, we will chat with him just because he's an interesting guy. Maybe he can even hang out with us longer. The first guy was supposed to be Phil Kirpin. He is with the
American Commitment.
Thank you.
Yeah. I was really looking forward to that talk too.
I was too, because
I know a lot about capital gains.
No, and this whole idea of the capital gains inflation tax, and that's going to come up, and then of course it's going to be, oh, it's another tax break for the rich, except for all the guys on the left have supported it for years.
Oh yeah, they all said it was a great idea in 1992. It was a good thing, but now that Trump wants to implement it, it's a bad thing.
It's a bad thing. So we thought, hey, this would be a good topic to bring to people because we're going to have to listen to it, and it would be nice to be a little bit smart about it. So we're going to remain dumb about it for the time being, and in our perfect world, we'll get smart about that later. There's stuff going on in Ashley's room. She's in there doing things. And it looks like maybe something has happened, something good. She's writing me a message. Our friend Myron, he's going to be on in 10 minutes.
Yeah.
That's nice. Okay. So
Ashley's the woman behind the curtain. We're supposed to look back there.
Pay no attention to the woman behind the curtain.
But we have to today because you've got the telephone. And, you know, of course, today is the day that, well, it started yesterday, actually, and I wasn't able to resolve it. My email has become, I don't know. It's got some sort of sickness where it can't find its password and all the things that.
That's not handy.
No, super not handy. And so all the things I've tried to do to reset the password, now it thinks I'm trying to impersonate myself. And so I'm going to have to.
Three strikes, you're out.
Yes.
Yeah, then you got to wait 20 minutes.
Well, I'm going to have to call a guy. I got to call the guy. So anyway, it's bad. I can't even email the guy that set up the first guy we're interviewing. I normally reach him by email, but I can't reach him by email because I can't email. So, you know, it's one of those days where we just can't get there from here. You know, I did play something yesterday. I was at a conference. I think we should do that. So, Ashley, why don't you bust onto your YouTube? We'll just do this in real time. And I will send you the little link here. I should have left it up. It was right there on my computer. It just seems like so many of these issues that we're having now, if you're over 30 years old, a lot of this stuff used to be some of our... Oh, you want me to play it from here? She's like, toss me a little cord here. Oh, we're going to do something new.
I'm scared.
We know you have the ability to change the channel. We just hope you'll hang with us. So anyway... The comedy of the, you know, years ago, comedy, we used to be able to joke about all sorts of things. And oddly enough, a lot of the things we used to joke about are real now.
Yeah, they're real, and you can't joke about
them. And you can't joke about them, but they used to, this used to be, this was like high humor. Mm-hmm. So for all those people that are Monty Python fans, you'll like this, and you'll probably remember it if you haven't seen it of late. It's from The Life of Brian. It's a Monty Python sketch, and they're sitting on the steps of the forum, and the title of the sketch is, I Want to Be a Woman. Now, remember in Monty Python, they talk with those British accents, so some of it's a little bit sometimes difficult to catch. But bottom line is there's three guys and a lady, and they're I'll post it online so you can see it after. But there are three men and a woman sitting on the steps, and they're kind of talking about what would be, I guess, the equivalent of our Constitution. And they're looking at, you know, how do they want this thing to go? What do they want it to say? And this little conversation breaks out. That is vaguely reminiscent of today, although this was 1979. Alec is a romantic. And that's a little commercial that's going to play until we can get past the ad. So irritating.
It's pretty amazing that
they haven't banned us from YouTube yet, though, so I guess that's good.
Joking about it in the 70s, and today it's
today it's real.
It's real.
Like ours, must reflect such a divergence of interest within its power base.
Agreed. Francis? Yeah. I think Judith's point of view is very valid, Rich. Provided the movement never forgets that it is the inalienable right of every man
or woman,
to rid himself
or herself.
Agreed.
Thank you, brother.
Or sister. Where was I?
A pronoun.
I think you finished. Oh, right. Furthermore, it is the birthright of every man
or woman.
Why don't you shut up about women, Stan? You're putting us off.
Women have a perfect right to play a part in our movement, Reg.
Why are you always on about women, Stan?
I want to be one.
What?
I want to be a woman. From now on, I want you all to call me Loretta.
What?
It's my right as a man.
What?
Well, why do you want to be Loretta, Stan?
I want to have babies.
You want to have babies?
It's every man's right to have babies if he wants them.
You can't have babies!
Don't you oppress me.
I'm not oppressing you, Stan. You haven't got a womb. Where's the fetus going to gestate? You're going to keep it in a box?
Here, I've got an idea. Suppose you agree that he can't actually have babies, not having a womb, which is nobody's fault, not even the Romans, but that he can have the right to have babies.
Good idea, Judith. We shall fight the oppressors for your right to have babies, brother. Sister. Sorry? What's the point?
What?
What's the point of fighting for his right to have babies when he can't have babies? It is symbolic of our struggle against oppression.
Symbolic of his struggle against reality.
And I'm sure we probably had those conversations for real in late.
I mean, well, we were having this. This came up yesterday. And so the idea of, you know, 75 genders or whatever we were doing. And it's like, and it made me think of this video. So anyway, I showed it to a group of people who most were unfamiliar. I'm like, this was 1979. We were joking about this stuff. And now
it's no joke.
Ripped right from the headlines.
Maybe that's where the idea came from.
Yeah. We can blame it all on Monty Python.
Monty Python.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, somebody's got to get blamed, and it's usually me. So let's blame Monty Python. I'll just take a break from being blamed. And let's see, I've got another fun video we'll do after we come back. We're going to take a quick break, maybe. I don't know. Ashley, give me a nod. Oh yeah, it's the up down nod. We've definitely taken a break. We're going to celebrate a little capitalism here. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, WeThePeopleRadio.us.
I
They even wrote a song for us.
That was just for today.
Oh, yeah. That's the only time we've ever played it.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. That's a lie. Really. That's a lie. So, I was at a Constitution convention yesterday, like just a kind of celebration of the Constitution, since the birthday of the Constitution is the 17th. So that'll be Tuesday. 232 years.
232, 231, yeah.
We picked 231, but that was the year we implemented. We wrote it the year before, so it's 232. And it's so anyway, we had a bunch of different speakers on different topics, and I was supposed to be at the end, and at the end it just, I don't know, we talked about the UN, we talked about all these things that, I don't know, kind of lights everybody's hair on fire. People start feeling really worried and, oh my gosh, we're not going to make it and it's not going to get fixed and the bad guys have got a leg up on us and we're doomed. And I just, if you haven't seen it already, and I will post this because watching it is as funny as listening to it, but the Democratic Socialists had a convention in Sacramento, August 5th. And so here are all these little Democratic Socialists. I'll just kind of like set the little stage for you. What, they're all wearing red bandanas around their neck.
Right.
And they call each other comrade, which is pretty darn funny.
And they're very hung up on rules.
And they like rules. This is the beginning of their, so this is all the Democratic Socialists have come to Sacramento and they are all meeting and they're going to have a convention because they, you know, they're going to take over. And I'm thinking, you know, as you listen to this, you probably hear, you know, Lenin and some of those guys and Marx, you know, twirling around in their graves. They're like, we didn't write all this madness for these idiots. So they're upset that other people are talking and things. And so the part you won't be able to, I mean, well, obviously you can't see it because we're on radio, but they've got their little hands in the air and they're wiggling their fingers. They call it jazz hands,
jazz
apparently.
Hands. You can't clap. You have to just raise your hands.
He doesn't want them to clap.
Shake them.
Yeah, you have to wiggle, you have to stick your arms in the air and wiggle your fingers. So picture all these knuckleheads in their little commie outfits with their bandanas and stuff, calling each other comrade. But let's hear about how tough they are, because this is the army
this is who we're up against.
This is the army that conservatives are up against. I think actually you're going to feel better. This is the moment of hope. And I've pushed the button. And I've
unmuted. No, he, him. I. Just
oh, wait,
say,
don't want to miss that part. Sorry,
I'll
start over.
Point of privilege. Quick point of personal
privilege.
Guys, first of all, James Jackson, Sacramento, he, him. I just want to say, can we please keep the chatter to a minimum? I'm one of the people who's very, very prone to sensory overload. There's a lot of whispering and chatter going on. It's making it very difficult for me to focus. Please, can we just, I know we're all fresh and ready to go, but can we please just keep the chatter to a minimum? It's affecting my ability to focus. Thank you.
Thank you, comrade. Okay, is there a speaker against name,
point
chapter,
of personal
pronoun?
Privilege. Point of personal privilege?
Yes.
Please do not use gendered language to address everyone.
Okay.
Shake
quick
your
point
hands.
Of privilege once
Shake
again.
Your hands.
Quick point of privilege once again. Hi, James Jackson, Sacramento DSA, he, him. I have already asked people to be mindful of the chatter of their comrades who are sensitive to sensory overload, and that goes double for the heckling and the hissing. It is also triggering to my anxiety. Like, the be comradely isn't just for, like, you know, let's keep things civil
what
or whatever.
A warrior.
It's so that
what
people aren't going to get triggered and so that it doesn't affect their performance as a delegate, okay? Your need to express yourself is important, but your need to express yourself should not trump or over.
Oops, he used the
like, I see that no one's clapping for me. It could be because I'm not engaging, but it also is because everyone's doing this. And that's really
raise
important
your hands,
because
fingers.
Those loud bursts of noise, even though this is a noisy space, when we can do something like reducing that, that's really important. So please don't clap, shoot up these. We have a lot of disabled comrades. And a lot of those are invisible disabilities. You don't know who it is that is having a more difficult time navigating this space. And this space was not created with all of their needs in mind. So it's up to us to modify that space to make sure that everybody is able to move in the ways that they need to move. And additionally, with the noise issue, like avoid hissing, avoid waving banners, right? because those there's all sorts of things. If you don't know what to do, show up these, right? I'm sure there's lots of ways that we can communicate to each other without needing to rely on something that's going to hurt somebody else. We have quiet rooms that are available. There's a range of options of these, right?
Teddy bears.
Please don't go into that space with anything that's like an aggressive scent, for instance, right?
You
don't
want to
put people in stressful situations that they don't consent to, right? And right-wing infiltrators who are trying to get in here, but it's going to be really traumatic for people if we're not making an affirmative effort to de-escalate each other and de-escalate ourselves, right? Take a deep breath.
They all had to do it together.
Doesn't feel better? Before you say anything. Don't really talk to anybody who doesn't have a credential, especially if you claim to be from the press. You have no idea who that person is. Please do not talk to anybody who identifies themselves as a member of the press without having credentials. Don't talk to cops. Don't talk to MAGA assholes. We're almost there.
Raise your hands.
But thank you. We are going to be visited tomorrow by some MAGA protesters. Is there anybody here who's done abortion clinic escort work? By all means, don't talk to cops if there are cops there for any reason at all, right? And if you do see someone talking to cops, let the marshals know.
We are
safe and we are strong because there's power in collective work.
Collective handshaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hand wringing.
Now, there are some sensitive people out there that are wanting to take control.
Are you trying to wear an aggressive scent?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I was. It was my high karate I put on this morning. Very aggressive.
Okay. All I can think of is, you know how they tell you when you're out in the wilderness, if you see a wild animal, you're supposed to like shape yourself like the letter X, like stick your arms in the air and stick your legs apart and then scream really loud. I thought, you know, if like three people went in that room and did that, they'd all
hit the floor.
You just hear them like timber going down right on the floor.
Yeah. It's incredible that they're so sensitive.
So those are the Democratic Socialists of America. Yes. They really couldn't have a convention because they couldn't decide what pronoun they were or whether or not they could wiggle banners or wave their fingers.
It took them 10 minutes just to get the pronouns.
Point of personal privilege.
Personal privilege.
The best part was at the conference I was at yesterday, some guy said that earlier in the day, but he didn't know the joke. And I thought, oh, that's kind of funny.
Yeah.
I wonder if he's going to like my video.
Yeah.
How awkward.
He kind of slunk down in his chair a little bit.
Yeah, it's too late. So what's going on in the control room, Ashley?
We have Myron on the
line. Stop it. We do?
Yay.
Myron, our hero. So let's adequately introduce our hero who has come to us early. Oh, and then I guess we probably have to take a stupid break, don't we? Oh, darn, capitalism keeps interfering. But, you know, without that, we'd have to... We'd have to stop rustling.
Democratic socialists
That's
involved.
Right. We'd have to stop wearing aggressive scents and clapping and waving banners. Our guest, Myron Magnet, is a prize-winning author and journalist. He's a really nice guy, too. Editor-at-large of City Journal, and he's the author of a new book called Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. He previously served as the editor of the City Journal and member of the board of directors of Fortune magazine. He's one of America's leading public intellectuals and recipient of the National Humanities Medal. Pretty fun, in 2008. He's a frequent media guest. We've had him on once before. We spoke about his book, Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, and I've got that interview posted for you. But in the discussion that we were having with him, there were all these interesting things about Clarence Thomas, just about him, the guy, and his life. And we realized we just didn't know enough, and probably no one else did either. So seemed like a good time to have him pop on with us and do a little chatting about that. So we're saving you from discussing taxes and all that. We're going to skip right over taxes and go right to something interesting, biography of someone who's awesome.
Not that taxes aren't interesting. Come on,
taxes are always captivating. People are like, oh, let's hurry and tune into that show about the taxes. But anyway, Myron, how's it going today? And thanks for being available.
Comrade Aaron and I, Comrade Bill.
Have you seen that video?
How is Z today?
Totally. Have you seen that yet? that video?
I was listening in as you were broadcasting it. I mean, I just can't believe
it. You got to see it. I'm going to put it on the webpage for today. I'm not kidding you. It is a gut buster.
It's awesome. It's absolutely awesome. You know, everything that starts on college campuses ends up in the wider culture. This is an argument that we cultural conservatives have been making for 30 years now. And it's just unbelievable that in this academic world of where there's only white privilege and white guilt and minority victimology, everybody has to be safe from everything. And it's a wonderful contrast with my hero Clarence Thomas, because one of the arguments that I make in Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution is that he is really trying to restore that Constitution of Liberty that the framers gave us 232 years ago. That Constitution that was something unexampled in human history and remains just as avant-garde today as it was then, namely the idea of a government that isn't supposed to rule you, but actually is just to keep you safe for self-government. Americans are going to have self-government. And there's nobody who has come up with something newer and shinier than that. But along with that vision of, you know, of a minimal government that just keeps you safe for freedom, went the idea that to be capable of citizenship in a society with such a government took a certain kind of character that you had to be a self-reliant, self-governing, responsible individual in order to be capable of the burdens of independence, and that it took a certain kind of culture to nurture citizens of that kind. And what's just amazing to me is that what we've just been listening to with these democratic socialists is that this is the opposite. We are now breeding a culture of wusses.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, we talk about the greatest generation. I mean, let's think back for a minute, right? Think back to Christmas Eve, 1776. There is Washington.
Yep.
On the Pennsylvania side of the Delaware River. His army has fled across New Jersey starting in the summer. So now their summer clothes have turned to rags, but it's winter. Their shoes have rotted away, and the ground is covered with ice. And their army is now so small that you could fit it into Madison Square Garden four times over. And Washington says, guys, we got to go back across the Delaware and fight those Hessians in Trenton. Who's willing to go with me? And nobody moves. And he rides up and down the line on his horse. And he asks again, he says, if ever your country needed you, it's today. Today, he said, never, never will anyone forget what you have done. This is the moment to decide. And finally, one guy takes a step forward, and then another and another, and finally, all of them have stood forward, and they march the, 12 miles through the snow, cross the Delaware, march into the oncoming snowstorm, where the Hessians, of course, don't expect them. It's a myth that they were drunk. They weren't drunk at all. They knew something was up, but they didn't know where it was coming from. And out of the blinding snow explode these crazed colonists with their muskets. And win the Battle of Trenton, and then go on 2 days later to win the Battle of Princeton. This is the turning point of the Revolutionary War. And of those men who stepped forward on those Christmas Eve, only a quarter of them lived to tell the story. Wow. So you want to know what it takes to be free and to maintain freedom. You actually have to have that kind of grit. And when you listen to a bunch of limp-wristed...
You're lucky if they even have limp wrists. We have to take a really swift break here. We kind of walked you into a box canyon there on that one. Sorry.
That's the West speaking.
Welcome to the box canyon. You got 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Just for you and anybody else who wants to, I did post both the Life of Brian thing where the guy talks about how he wants to be a woman. So the Monty Python skit is on there, and also the Democratic Socialist Convention. And seriously, don't believe us. Go on and watch. It was real. And that one poor idiot kept giving his first name, last name in the city he lives in.
And his.
Wouldn't you love to work with that guy? You'd just be never ending. You'd be in the principal's office every day.
If he works for Google, they'll promote it.
Probably. He's probably true. All proud of himself. That's sad. Well, we mock him. So anyway, right. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us. We will be right back. And we're back in reality.
Myron, I have to ask you, if any of these folks that were at the convention were huddled around a campfire having to cross that river, I don't think a single one of them would have done it.
No, they wouldn't have done it. And had they come across, they wouldn't have been able to fire either because it would have been much too aggressive.
Well,
the noise would have scared them.
They would have been holding guns.
And let alone all the aggressive scents that there probably were.
Yeah, there were probably a lot of aggressive scents.
Well, yeah, the smell of the powder would have done it for them.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
So I think there's, it's funny, I mean, it may be that you are old enough to remember this too, but there was only one downside of the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is when I was young, we used to be able to say, what, do you really want to live under a regime like communism? And there were so many stories from dissidents or escapees of what it was like to live under tyranny. And so we were well aware that we had in America something that was extraordinary and well worth defending. But now that the Soviet Union is just a kind of thug, is merely a thugocracy, without any ideology whatsoever. It's kind of hard to say, oh, well, look at these evil regimes. Look what can happen. And so we don't appreciate that we live in a free republic, and one of the things that makes it free is that we have this extraordinary constitution that understands that people have within them the capacity for evil and the capacity for wanting to rule and control others. So our framework of government does not give any single person or body the power to turn into an unelected despot.
But that's where they've forgotten that part. I mean, they continue to
misrepresent it.
Well, they misrepresent it, but they also believe that we can do it differently. I mean, we can be socialist and we wouldn't turn out that way. When in fact, every single time it's tried, it's failed. And don't you think it's a little bit belligerent to think that we could do it differently and we wouldn't turn out that way?
Well, I think they have a fundamental misunderstanding of human psychology. They believe that people are naturally good. And that left to themselves, people would cooperate just like in nursery school. Everybody would take turns. Everybody would share.
But they don't. They never did.
And they never did in nursery school,
no.
You know, either. No. And what they believe is that social inequities are what make for human disagreement, and that if only we had a proper society, then natural human goodness would out. Well, that's just not the way it is. Like every other creature, women, comrade, are aggressive,
yeah. Exactly.
Right? And, you know, wish to take what other people have, use them sexually without their consent, kill them, dominate, enslave, what have you. So yay for us that we actually found a way to create a government to protect us from internal and external aggression, while at the same time creating all these internal guardrails so that the governors don't turn into the rulers and the oppressors. That's pretty fantastic. But as I say, as with, you know, as Clarence Thomas has insisted over and over again in his, everybody thinks of him as being the silent justice. He is very far from silent. The guy is an inveterate speech maker, and he loves to participate in symposia that you can find all over YouTube. One of the things he really likes to point out is that you've got to have this sense of self-reliance in order to be a free citizen, and that's why he's always talking about his own biography. He's kind of holding himself up as an example. You know, here's this guy who was born in a kerosene-lit shanty in a Georgia swamp. He was poor. But he remembers his very earliest years in an idyllic kind of Huck Finn way, as the kids ran around these swamps and bayous in South Georgia. And then when he was seven or so, his mother, who by this time had divorced his father, moved him and his little brother to Savannah, to a horrible Savannah slum, where he says, on her meager maid's wages, we knew hunger without the prospect of eating and cold without the prospect of warmth. He speaks about the privations of that year. And finally, his mother realized that she couldn't keep him, and I think didn't really want to anymore. She had a new man by then. So she turned the two little boys over to her father and stepmother, who just lived around the corner a few blocks away, but it was like light years away. It was a kind of Huck Finn-like transformation. So Grandfather Anderson, this is Clarence Thomas's mother's father, Myers Anderson, was the child of a single parent, had grown up knocked from pillar to post, and at a certain point had fathered an illegitimate child before he got married. But he decided to make something of himself. He is your true American self-made man. So to start with, he converted to Catholicism from the free-form Southern Baptist church he'd been raised in. He started a wood and coal delivery business, which by the time Clarence and his brother were little kids was now a teeny fuel oil delivery business. But it was enough to provide him with a cinder block house that he built himself with porcelain indoor plumbing and a full fridge. He and his wife had never had children together. So Clarence and his little brother kind of filled a need in their lives. And so his grandfather gave them this extremely structured, old-fashioned upbringing, enrolled them in Catholic school, very strict school, segregated like everything else in Savannah, but teaching that all men were created equal in the eyes of God. So
that was actually a lucky break for them at that point.
Unbelievable. And, yeah. You know, the nuns who ran that school were mostly Irish immigrants. The whites in Savannah got wind of what they were doing in this school and just, you know, dismissed them all as the nigger sisters.
They were just
scandalized by this. But no, the nuns had them learn the preamble to the Constitution by heart.
Trust me, I went to Catholic school. I can still recite all the prepositions in order.
Hold that.
You had to stand up and do it. You were a dunce.
Well, hold that thought. Hold that thought, Aaron. We got a break.
Got to take a really real quick break. We'll be right back.
Last one before
with
the
our guest Myron Magnet that we pulled in early, and we're going to keep as a hostage for the next hour. Is that cool with you, Myron?
Yeah. All right.
I'd love to ask you while everyone can hear you.
Nice.
No pressure.
Right. Thank you, comrade.
Yeah,
we'll be right back.
What are you going to do? Wine?
Point of personal privilege.
Point of personal privilege. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That's what the left hears when Donald Trump talks. Every time he speaks, they can hear that song in the background. good call, Ashley. So, do we have a lot of stories like this in our Supreme Court justices? I don't know how many others you've studied, but is this a pretty common story? Because it seems really remarkable to me.
No, I mean,
he's one of a kind.
You wonder, can you go from log cabin to White House in 21st century America? Well, this is pretty darn close, right?
Yeah.
From a Georgia swamp to the Supreme Court bench.
Yeah.
I mean, this is this is a really extraordinary man, and I think I said to you the last time we talked that I think that Clarence Thomas is the most consequential jurist of our age, and certainly his backstory is something different. So here he is growing up in the Savannah slum, and from the time he's in third grade, his grandfather puts him to work in the fuel oil business, delivering oil. You know, and I mean, it's not enough that they have to get up way before dawn on winter mornings. No. In order to make sure they don't doze off in the truck, Grandfather Anderson disconnects the heater so that the heat won't lull them to sleep. So they're freezing.
Such a grandfather trick,
right? I mean, they go to Catholic school, you know, until school lets out. Then they deliver oil or take orders, and then in the family, from Reconstruction days, there were 60 acres in southeast Georgia. I mean, you want to hear something, you know, sort of grotesquely ironic. Across the street from where their ancestors had been enslaved, and so the family owned these 60 acres, and nobody had any use for them. So Grandfather Anderson took the two boys down there one summer, and they built a cinder block house with their own hands and broke up the land and cultivated it and planted crops. And then every summer thereafter, they would spend the entire summer going down there, growing crops, tending the fields, raising livestock. At the end of the summer, they'd butcher a few animals and put them in the freezer in Savannah for the winter. And they always, like anybody who farms, right, they always had too much, so they would share it with their neighbors. And so he had like a pioneer upbringing. If you want, he learned how to be self-reliant by relying on himself. He was, as he says, we were never on the grid. It's not like we had an off-grid existence. We were never near it.
Yeah. Wasn't an option.
He's like, you know, a sturdy self, you know, sturdy, independent yeoman of the kind who stood at the bridge in Concord and Lexington, you know. His ambition, and certainly his grandfather's ambition for him, is that he should be the first black priest in Savannah. And he goes off to a seminary.
How old was he at that point?
He was 17 or 18.
Wow.
He went off to a kind of seminary preschool at the very end of high school, and then off to a real seminary when he was, I guess he just turned 18, and he went off to a seminary in St. Louis, and that was the year that Martin Luther King got shot, and he was one of two black kids in this seminary, and one of his fellow seminarians, you know, in these, he met real racism of a kind he hadn't seen even in segregated Savannah in the seminaries. And when Martin Luther King got shot, one of his fellow seminarians said, "Good, I hope the son of a bitch dies." And
it's unbelievable to hear that out of a seminarian.
Well, that's exactly what Thomas says.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
He says that did it for my vocation, right? Mm-hmm. If somebody who was supposed to be a man of God would wish this on another man of God, this is not for me.
Yeah.
So this caused an irreparable break with his grandfather. But in any event, by then, the very dynamic new president of Holy Cross was out recruiting smart black kids, found Clarence, and recruited him. So he started there, I think, as a sophomore, And then, of course, immediately became a black radical. Because it was the beginning of affirmative action, there was a handful of black kids on the Holy Cross campus. They had their black floor in the dorm, and they talked about how oppressed and abused they were, and how the revolution was coming, and how America was this irreparably racist society, and on they went in this vein. And he was in the Black Students Union, and he wore overalls with one of the straps undone and the proper radical fashion of the time. And,
just don't picture that with him now. You know, you only.
Well, he was thinner then. and then at the very end of his junior year, he went off to Holy Crosses in Worcester, Mass. And he went off to a demonstration in Harvard Square that turned into a grade A riot. A friend of mine was watching it and said, "Boy, it was violent. I mean, businesses got torched, cops got grabbed and roughed up. There were injuries. There was tons of damage. There was plenty of looting." And Thomas gets back to Holy Cross in the morning and goes into the chapel and starts to pray and prays to God to take this anger away from him, because he says if he goes on like this, it's just going to ruin his life. And he said, you know, he asked himself at that moment, did he believe in America? Did he believe that in some fundamental way what the nuns had taught him about this being a country dedicated to the proposition that all men were created equal? And he said, yeah, he did. He believed that.
In spite of what he'd been through. Yep. And so this would have been, what, around 68, somewhere in there? And
it was around 71.
71, okay. So he had a pretty good perspective at that point in his life of what things were truly like.
He did.
Fellers, I hate to be the bearer of bad news, but we have to take a quick break for the news. It's either capitalism or the news. Everything's breaking in on us. What the heck?
All right. We'll
but we'll be back
up
with our guest, Myron Magnet. We're talking about Clarence Thomas, Justice Clarence Thomas. And you're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Good afternoon, and welcome back. Here we go. Welcome back to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And we've had sort of a odd beginning there on our first hour, but I really do hope you go back and at least listen to the back half of the first hour. We started early with our guest, Myron Magnet. He was supposed to be second hour, but we pulled a hostage maneuver and got him on early. And have a couple fun videos for you online that it'll just make you happy. You can't have too much of that. So we're discussing Clarence Thomas today. And what were we talking about on the break, Bill? You had made some comment, and I said, let's ask him about it.
Oh.
He ate peanuts, I ate a banana, we came back in here. Oh, we're the worst.
Well, we were talking about
before the break. So we were talking about Clarence Thomas's biography.
Yeah,
right.
And as I recount in Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution, he went through this real black radical phase.
That was what we were thinking about. Like every other kid goes to college and kind of goes off the rails a little bit.
Yeah, and he said, he said, I was a black radical. He said, and then I grew up. of course, what's interesting is that he kind of had to think his way to conservatism. He did it in a funny way. I mean, first he took the the kind of black separatism, black self-help strand in Malcolm X. And he would talk about that a lot because he didn't want his friends to know that he was actually moving to the right. Then he got to Yale Law School, and, you know, he was hearing about all the discrimination there, but he said, well, just, you know, wait. He was seeing that affirmative action that was really underway at that time was not doing anybody, was not doing its supposed beneficiaries any good, because all these smart black kids would be admitted to the Yale Law School, but it would be a school that would be a rank or two above where their preparation should have put them. And so had they gone to, you know, the state law school, say, they would have succeeded brilliantly, but here, up against the smartest kids in the country, and the kids who'd been to, you know, Newton and Brookline high schools and to private school, they weren't cutting it. So as they were failing, they would be resentful. Of course, you know, if you have a choice between blaming yourself and blaming the system, it's easier to blame the system. And that's what they would do. So instead of having the desired effect of creating this new class of well-educated, highly motivated black leaders, it was taking the people who would have formed that class and turning them into resentful failures. As to those who succeeded, like Thomas, what he discovered when he got out of Yale Law School, I mean, I can hear his voice when he says, I couldn't get a job. I couldn't get a job. Because everybody assumed that, oh, here's a black graduate of the Yale Law School. He must be a dummy. He must have got through only on account of affirmative action, which was certainly not true in his case.
How was he able to get into Yale?
Well, he got into Yale partly on affirmative action, but he would have got into Yale any which way, because he was a cum laude graduate of Holy Cross College. He was a really excellent undergraduate student. But, you know, he also got in because there was this affirmative action program way. So he got a boost. And, you know, if you were to ask him this question, he wouldn't be able to answer it, you know. If you were to say, Mr. Justice, did you get into Yale on your own merits or because of affirmative action, he would be embarrassed to give you the answer. And that's part of the problem with affirmative action,
right?
He would tell you. You don't know. You don't know what you have actually achieved on your own, and therefore you can't take confidence in the accomplishment, and that is really subversive to your ability to function in the world. So he said, you know, he wanted a regular corporate law firm job, and all they were offering him were, you know, pro bono type jobs where he's gonna work with the poor and the disadvantaged. And so finally, he got a job working in the Attorney General's office of Missouri. And he said, I don't want to work on any race stuff. He said, I just put me in criminal law. And so he learned a lot there. He said, he'd gone to this riot in Harvard Square in support of the black political prisoners, the imprisoned Black Panthers. Well, I mean, what he learned is that all these supposed black political prisoners weren't black political prisoners at all. He had a case of some guy who held a blade to a black woman's throat to rape it to a black woman's child's throat, so that he could rape and sodomize the mother, you know, who was afraid for her kid's life. He said, this is not a victim. This is not a political prisoner. This is just a plain, flat-out thug, evil thug. And he came to learn that the reason that there are more blacks in prison, that there's a disproportional number of blacks in prison, is because guess what? blacks commit crimes at a disproportionate rate. And guess who their victims are? Disproportionately other blacks. And that's one of the things that makes black inner cities so difficult to succeed in, because kids are scared to go to school, because the streets are infested with thugs. And once they're in school, there's no order in the school, because guess what? The Supreme Court has taken the authority to discipline away from teachers and principals. And then you get to your housing project, and it's a pandemonium. You can't study because, once again, the Supreme Court has taken away the right of the housing authorities to keep order there. So, you know, this practical experience taught him an awful lot about how the world really is. And the Attorney General, and forgive me, I'm blanking on the name here, became elected senator and went to Washington and took Thomas with him. And so Thomas was now a Republican senatorial staffer. And got invited to a meeting of young black leaders organized by the great economist Thomas Sowell out in California. And by now, Thomas had been reading Sowell's collected works becoming increasingly convinced that the way of black success was not to organize politically and force the government to give more welfare, to decriminalize crime, to, you know, forcibly desegregate schools by busing, to have affirmative action. It was for blacks to go out into the private economy and make their own successes and then be accepted by the larger society in the terms that society understands, which is accomplishment, success, merit. And there was no reason why blacks couldn't do that at all. So he's at this conference and he's just chatting to one of the fellow audience members, and he's talking about how he really objects to welfare, because when his mother moved to Savannah, she took him and his little brother with her, but she left their older sister behind in the Georgia swamp community with their relatives. And so his family is a kind of natural experiment in what upbringing does. So there's Thomas and his little brother, who grew up in, you know, an intact two-adult family, even though they were his grandparents, not his parents. Whereas his sister grows up sort of from pillar to post and ends up on welfare. And he's saying, you know, and you can't, he's saying to his seatmate at this conference, you can't believe how dependent she is. If the mailman is a day late with her check, she gets angry. That's how totally dependent she is. And her kids are getting like that. Well, his seatmate turned out to be Juan Williams, the reporter for the Washington Post, who the next day publishes a profile of Clarence Thomas in the Washington Post, which brings him to the attention of the Reagan administration, who put him first in the Civil Rights Division of the Education Department.
Was it a fair profile? I mean, was it
very
accurate?
Fair, yeah. Very accurate. But I mean, you know, what he said about his sister was just, you know, like a bombshell. Like, and I mean, nobody in his family was talking to him for a while after that. And other black people were saying, how could you be so insensitive to say such a thing as that? You know, it's like wearing aggressive perfume.
It was like waving a banner or something.
Yeah. And then he ends up being the head of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. So you know, now he's studying, wait a minute, how come blacks aren't getting ahead, right? I mean, his job is to make sure that blacks get equal employment opportunity.
Right, so he's getting ready to say a lot of things that are not going to be popular that, you know. We have to take a really quick break, but honestly, it's really unfortunate. He didn't have more clout or something, and then we could stop having this conversation, but it'll probably never end.
Well, he's got clout. He's, he,
I know. I mean,
Supreme
it's just
court justice. That's going to be our punchline, Aaron.
It's just too bad he can't make some sort of a vaccine or something.
He's doing it.
Oh, man. All right. We'll be right back. Our guest is Myron Magnet. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the wind that blows from the north and south and east. Oh, mercy, mercy me. All things ain't what they used to be now. Oil wasted on the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy, mercy.
Oh, if you're tired of the same old story, oh, baby, turn some pages.
Yeah, if only we could make people understand what Clarence Thomas figured out a long time ago.
Well, we're working on it. Tell everybody to buy Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution. That'll be a good start.
But you know, he is who he is because of his upbringing and the perspective he had on life.
And instead of making it making him a victim and a weakling and demand that everybody else become a victim and a weakling because somehow that was going to make everybody better.
Equal.
He said, hey, wait a second.
But this is now a whole governmental philosophy. He says, right. You know, we've come to the point, and this brings us back to your democratic socialists, you know.
With their
limp wrists. I mean, he's saying, look, people, it's certainly black radicals who want government to remake society for their benefit, but not just black radicals, but now everybody on the left seems to feel that government exists to remove adversity from life. He says this is a fundamental misconception of the human condition. Everybody, and this is not just black people, but all people, face some kind of adversity or other, at least at some point in their lives. And what you have to do is be able to look at the adversity and say, okay, I can grapple with this and try to master it and be the captain of my soul and overcome, right? I will overcome. This makes you a much stronger person, gives you the self-confidence to take on the next challenge and the kind of inner grit to say, wait a minute, I'm going to be responsible for myself. And he said, you want to know what? The dirty little secret of freedom is that you are crossing the prairie of life at your own risk and all by yourself. And you have to do it. You have to take responsibility for it and be ready to face the obstacles that will come along. And he said that a politics that is based on the idea that government can somehow remove all these bumps on the trail of life is delusional. No government has the capacity to do that. It does not have the capacity to do it for black people. And as your democratic socialist friends having their convention right now will discover, it does not have the power to do it for any people You know, I mean, we know the way that finally ends up with some kind of Jacobin with his guillotine, or some kind of Lenin.
Oh yeah, it always turns out that way. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it always does. But so there's, you know, so this kind of charade that's going on up there in Sacramento right now is just the exact opposite of what American culture needs. We need people who say, hey, we have a free country here with all its, with by the way, it's rather few faults. And by the way, we have spent the last 60 years at least, you know, the center of our politics has been to try to make up for and undo all of the residue of 200 years of slavery and 100 years of Jim Crow. And certainly we have gone too far in many respects in this effort, but heaven knows the intention of, you know, mainstream American politics has been to atone for and correct this founding blemish in American society. Well, you know what? White society has now done everything it can possibly do to atone for slavery and Jim Crow. And what Clarence Thomas would say is, you know, it's now up to us black people, and we have to move off the dime on this.
So you're thinking he's probably not behind the reparations movement?
Well, I mean, it's so interesting to look at his jurisprudence through the lens of race, because I mean, he's written this, you know, written these very powerful anti-affirmative action opinions, saying, "Come on, you know, who is benefiting here? Who is benefiting from turning people who would succeed into resentful failures? The only people who are benefiting are the white college administrators who can feel that they're virtuous because they've got their quotas." And he says, and by the way, who is benefiting from these Supreme Court decisions that resulted in striking down vagrancy and loitering laws that has depoliced inner cities? Who has benefited but criminals, and who suffers from them are the good majority of inner city communities who are principally black and Hispanic people. And you're going to make them pay to make you feel good because you're saying, oh, these poor criminals, they're really victims of an unjust system. And who is benefiting from taking away the traditional authority of teachers and principals, who were always understood to be in loco parentis, you know, there were no due process rights for pupils in grammar schools and high schools.
not my school.
So who is benefiting from turning these schools into anarchies? So, you know, here the taxpayers of America are shelling out, you know, in where I live in New York, we're shelling out $20,000 a year per kid in the public schools to get this D-minus education in which few kids graduate and few of those who graduate actually are literate and employable. What have we actually done here by making the object of our school system for the last 50 years be to make racial equality and to make the world safe for juvenile delinquents? We have turned everything upside down. So, I mean, he's got a whole bunch of opinions that are saying, this is wrong, this is wrong, this is wrong. Who do we benefit by Supreme Court decisions that in effect nullify the Bill of Rights so that the government of New London, Connecticut, for example, can take away your house and give it to somebody else who's going to make a higher value use of the property in order to raise the tax base of New London and do what with it? Well, raise the salaries and pensions of the politicians who are overseeing all of this. I mean, there's, you know, so that's a real kind of tyranny, which he sees. And he says, by the way, I grew up under state-sanctioned segregation, and that's as close to totalitarianism as I would like to get. So he does recognize totalitarianism, and he does recognize with it when the government says, oh, I am here to do this good thing for you, you can end up having tyranny. That's why we have, at least for starters, there are four 2015 opinions of his attacking
would you be okay to sketch those for us when we come back?
Yeah, I will.
That would be awesome. And I found a song. I should have played it earlier for you fellas. This goes out to all those men with their little red bandanas at the Democratic Socialist Convention that we highlighted earlier. You can see the video on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Here you go. It's official. We have dance moves for radio. But we were killing it there for like 30 seconds. So
we were talking about the four opinions.
But I want to know, before we do that, though, I want to know why. I mean, is it just me and I'm not paying attention? Or are his opinions and ideas kind of swept under the rug a little bit? Is there a reason that he's not more prominently figured and we don't hear more?
Oh, yeah, he's totally out of the mainstream. I mean, this is not what the Yale and Law School, the Yale and Harvard Law Schools teach. This is what the Founding Fathers taught. And so he's resuscitating them. You know, one of the arguments I make in Clarence Thomas and the Lost Constitution is that part of the, or at the center of the anger that we see in American political discourse right now is that we're living under two different constitutions. There, guys like us believe in the Constitution of Freedom. We are the Freedom Party, and we believe in a constitution that keeps the world safe for freedom and requires self-reliance. And then there's the Fairness Party that believes in the living constitution. And that's kind of what, you know, this is what all the elites believe in right now. It started with Woodrow Wilson, who really despised the Founding Fathers, despised the framers, thought the Constitution was this silly, antique, obsolete document. Because we've passed the age of constitutionalism, we're in the age of administration, and that what we need is a fast-moving Darwinian government that adapts to changing times instantly, and the way to do that is to be governed by a bunch of Ivy League-trained experts, supposedly apolitical, like Mr. Comey, in working in administrative agencies, in order to, do expert things to tell us how to live. Well, this is not self-government for sure. This is Frederick the Great's government by enlightened bureaucrats. But the thing about enlightened despotism is that the Enlightenment evaporates, leaving only the despotism behind. So But Woodrow Wilson's vision prevailed and was supersized by the New Deal. And Franklin Roosevelt then created all these administrative agencies, which he confessed, he admitted, were a fourth branch of government that had no foundation in the Constitution whatsoever. But you remember, he threatened the Supreme Court that he was going to enlarge it and pack it with New Dealers if they didn't go along with this stuff, if they didn't let him use the Commerce Clause of Article 1 of the Constitution to take control of the entire American economy, which was the program of the New Deal. And the Supreme Court, and it was a justice named Roberts who folded on this one, said, okay, you got us. We're going along with it. And so the Supreme Court just crumbled and did not live up to its oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So we got this giant administrative state from the SEC to the FEC to the National Labor Relations Board and on and on and on through the whole alphabet of these whippersnapper lawyers, unelected by anybody, making laws like a legislature, carrying them out like an executive, and adjudicating and punishing infractions of them like a judiciary. This is the administrative state, and we've still got it. And they're still telling us what to do through the Environmental Protection Agency. You know the story of that guy in Colorado who dug two ponds to protect himself in case forest fires broke out. He needed a reservoir to pump out of to fight forest fires. The EPA charges him with polluting the navigable waterways of the United States, the nearest one of which is 40 miles away. And the guy ends up paying a $130,000 fine. This is just a rancher paying a $130,000 fine and being sentenced to prison for 18 months. Now, if you want to know what hokey Star Chamber, quote, justice this is, you will notice that the Trump administration rescinded this regulation just last week. So here's this guy with his $130,000 fine and his 18-month prison sentence. He's dead now, so there's nothing you can do about it, right? But the EPA just rescinded the rule. It's like this is not self-government, not self-government at all. But so even Clarence Thomas looks out on this, and he says, fellas, this has to stop, right? The Supreme Court was asleep at the switch, or chicken, when we let the administration of Franklin Roosevelt and then all subsequent administrations do this. We were wrong, and one of the things that makes Thomas such a judicial outlier is he says, and you know what, my fellow justices, you believe in the doctrine of stare decisis, the doctrine that once we make a decision, that's the law, and you have to abide by it. It is settled law. He said, okay, that's the unwritten British Constitution that the colonists lived under for 150 years before they decided they didn't want to live under that because you didn't have freedom under it. They wanted a written Constitution whose meaning does not change, and so that's why we had it. And he said, and by the way, even the English recognized that judges can make mistakes, so they have no problem in a judge saying, hey, we're going to correct the error of our predecessors here and change this ruling. He says the Supreme Court has to do it now. So if the Supreme Court has made a mistake, and by the way, we're only human, and we have made mistakes in the past, and some of them have been real doozies, we have to overrule these. We have to overturn them and go back to that Constitution of Liberty that the framers gave us, and this is where Thomas is getting real traction now. He has, in Gorsuch especially, and Kavanaugh to some degree, and Roberts when he's being Chief Justice Jekyll rather than Chief Justice Hyde, he has he has colleagues who are going along on this, so they actually have been overturning precedents in this last term.
Have they overturned Supreme Court decisions, though?
They have overturned Supreme Court decisions. Yes, Bill, they have.
Okay.
And you can do that. That is okay. And, of course, this is what has the left shivering in its shoes.
I was going to say, they're in panic.
Oh, my God, how you're going to overturn settled law? This is what Dianne Feinstein is always asking in the confirmation hearings. How do you feel about settled law? Of course, what she means is Roe v. Wade. You know, and the answer, and Clarence Thomas has already given it in an absolutely stunning opinion called Stenberg v. Carrard, in which he says, how come nobody ever describes partial birth abortion, so-called? He says, because to describe it is to condemn it, because it is just plain infanticide. Mm-hmm. And he said, okay, now I am going to read into the record of the Supreme Court of the United States a delivery room nurse's description of a partial birth abortion. And this is family radio. I'm not going to repeat it. But it is murder.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's just plain murder. And it's horrible. But the point is, whatever your views about abortion, you know, whatever your views about infanticide, even, you know, if we were to make it legal, it is not in the power of unelected judges to make that determination, right? It is with abortion, the question, unless you are a Catholic, which I'm not, the question always is, where do you draw the line, right? Do you draw it at viability? Do you draw it at heartbeat? But even the original Roe v. Wade decision admitted that somewhere there is a line that a decent society does not cross.
Yeah, you can't kill them once they're alive.
And
now they're all good with it.
Kill your 2-year-old. And by the way, and you can't kill your 2-hour-old. And you can't pull a living baby out of the womb and kill it when its feet are hanging out, you know, which is what partial birth abortion is.
Right.
But it's not for the Supreme Court to draw that line. We live in a self-governing republic, and if we wish to criminalize things, then it needs to be the people's elected representatives who say what is legal and what is illegal, and it just becomes tyranny if you have unelected judges making up law out of whole cloth. And that is what the Warren Court brought in with a vengeance, and what the Supreme Court then did for decades afterwards, and what Clarence Thomas is working so hard to reverse, and is now, by the way, getting some traction in doing this, because, yes, the Supreme Court has been willing to overturn Supreme Court opinions. And that's something that, you know, you should see how terrified Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer are on this. I mean, they're shaking in their shoes because they can't see. And it's not, you understand, I mean, Justice Thomas, of course, you know, being a devout Catholic, feels very strongly that life begins at conception, plain and simple. And
yeah, because it does. Because after that, it becomes a person.
Okay, but just to stick on the constitutional issue, right? You know, the constitutional issue is, whatever your views about where to draw the line on this, you know, the United States Constitution does not give that power to 9 unelected justices, period. Mm-hmm. So that even if we were to agree that abortion in some form should be legal, it's not the Supreme Court's business to make that decision. It's the business of elected legislators to make that decision. And they could be wrong, but in any event, it's legitimate. Whereas when the Supreme Court is wrong, it has no legitimacy whatsoever. And that's the situation that we're in right now. So what
interesting, and you don't hear that very often. So we have to take one more really quick break here before the top of the hour. And, you know, we made fun of the guy at the Democratic Socialist Convention, so I had a song for all the women that were probably at the Socialist Convention because I know how much they like to ride their bikes. So I thought maybe I should be an equal opportunity maligner, and so here's one for them. You're listening to We the People. Myra and I have always wanted to play Fat Bottom Girls, but I've never been able to work it into a show. So God love you for being on and just like giving me the open door.
Gee, let's not even go down that road, Aaron.
A step too far right there.
What? I figure we had all the comrades kind of, you know, twisting in the wind. We might as well just go all the way.
Oh, jeez. Watch out.
You got to watch those Queen songs that could go either way on you.
Yeah.
So what have we missed? What have we not
what
talked
we
about?
Missed? Not
What do
not
people need
really
to know about him that's like...
Not really much. I'll tell you, I think one thing that we need to know is that this recent... stay of an order to overturn the latest Trump administration attempt to rein in illegal immigration came from the Ninth Circuit Court
That's
of Appeals.
That's crazy, isn't it?
Well,
seen that
now,
coming.
You know, the Trump administration has now managed to confirm its 150th federal judge, and 20% of them are Clarence Thomas ex-clerks. So if you wonder, is Justice Thomas actually having an effect on our judiciary, there is proof positive. Did you ever think you would see the day when the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals would do something conservative?
No.
Sensible.
So it's a revolution.
Yeah, that blew my mind when that came down. I wonder what effect his policy of not taking referrals from the senators for those districts typically...
Oh, allowing them to...
Yeah.
Your blue slips.
Right. Yeah. And he said, no, I don't need one. And he appointed his
own. He's going to move forward there.
Yeah, and I mean, look, these are customs. And, you know, it's a funny kind of thing. This is a government with a written constitution, but... Yes, we also do have sort of Burkean traditions in our government, such as the one that George Washington set when he stepped down after two terms, and no one has presumed to overstep that except for Franklin Roosevelt. But that's not a law, or wasn't a law. right? It was just a tradition. Same with a nine-man Supreme Court or a nine-justice Supreme Court. There, it does not say in Article 3 how many judges there will be on the
Supreme
Court.
Wasn't there five originally?
Yes.
Was it always nine?
Yes, and it grew over time, and so when FDR threatened to enlarge the court and pack it, he could do that. Nobody's quite sure of what the machinery would be, whether he could do it by fiat, but he did have control of Congress, so they could have simply passed a law saying the Supreme Court, you know, since Article 3 says that the judicial branch shall consist of a Supreme Court and such other courts as Congress may establish, well, it seems like you can, you know, the inference is that Congress could expand the Supreme Court to being, you know, as big as the UN, and as diverse. So we do kind of live by these traditions too. So there is a kind of, you know, there's a tension always.
Right.
There's a danger in this.
Right.
Hmm. Well, I think most people don't know much about Clarence Thomas. Tell me this. How old is he? I forgot what you said when he was... When was he born?
How old is he? He is 71, I think. 71 or 72. Oh, wait a minute. He's 73.
Okay. So he's not...
Mm-hmm.
No, he's young.
Yeah?
He's young.
Getting younger every day from my perspective.
And he's peppy, and he's lost a lot of weight, and he stopped smoking cigars long ago, and, you know, he doesn't drink. He's doing great. I mean, he's, there have been all these rumors about the possibility of him retiring, and he just put paid to them a while ago, and said, look, this is my calling, you know, this is my calling, to bring back the framers' constitution, and I'm not going anywhere. So I think that, you know, I hope that he will be spared for many years, what he is doing and what he has been doing in now 28 years on the bench, six or 800 opinions, is just kind of laying out a blueprint for restoration of the Constitution of Liberty, patiently, training all these clerks in the kind of jurisprudence that he sees to be appropriate and legitimate jurisprudence. And by the way, you know, teaching law school classes in Washington too. I mean, he's an active and busy guy, and it's starting to have fruit because you know, there is now this whole army out there of Clarence Thomas trained lawyers and Thomas trained judges, we have our blueprint for restoring the framers' constitution, and we have our troops who can carry it out. And if there were to be four more years of a Republican president, you know, it's possible that there would be yet another Supreme Court or another couple of Supreme Court vacancies, so that we actually could have a conservative Supreme Court for, you know, 40 years to come after this. And, you know, when I say a conservative Supreme Court, I do not mean a Supreme Court that has a conservative agenda, a conservative
right.
political agenda.
Because they can't have a political view. I mean,
of course, everybody has.
Everybody does.
But yeah, But you can't, if you're a judge, you just have to say, what does the Constitution require? And that is a very, that is the question that a conservative judge asks. What does the Constitution, as the framers wrote it, require? A liberal or radical or lefty judge, I will not use the word progressive because there is nothing progressive,
there's nothing progressive about
left,
it.
Right? But what he asks is, what is my policy choice and how can I rationalize it by some cockamamie interpretation of some precedent that we had 10 or 15 years ago? And that's how he argues, so that, you know, if you will just get limited government, if you want to have, you know, as the constitutional scholar Raoul Berger said, the people have the right to go to hell in their own way. If you don't believe that, you're not a Democrat. I mean, I get that. I get that. But
Myron,
it's the people who have to do it. The
exactly.
people, not the judges.
Yep.
We thank you. Myron Magnet, you're a gentleman and a scholar. Thank you so much.
Thank you, and the book is Clarence Thomas
and
the
Lost Constitution. You can find that at wethepeopleradio.us, everything about our guest and the recording of today's show.